Hello and welcome to Anger Management. My name is Georg Dietz.
And I'm Karin Pettersson.
And we are, as always, looking for the people who have answers for our questions about the future of democracy, which is inherently linked to the nature of technology and the way that digital world, digital technologies, digital capitalism disrupts most of our way of doing things, most of our institutions.
And we were very, very happy and I guess lucky to have...
Very, very happy.
Very happy and very, very lucky to have an hour with Joey Ito.
Basically, it's...
It's like having an hour with the Pope. Yeah?
Yeah, just Obama had an hour.
Obama had an hour with Joey Ito.
Yeah.
Anyway, he's the head of the of MIT's Media Lab.
A renaissance figure.
He's an entrepreneur. According to urban legend, he commutes between Cambridge and Japan every week. I don't know if that's true, but he has a TV show in Japan. What else? Well, you took a class with him, an awareness class?
Yeah, it was a lovely, lovely class about meditation. We read the Dalai Lama, Martin Buber. It was really interesting how he, I think, is aware of how the mind is changing in our digital age and how that's the losing of focus, which I think is also part of his problem. So if, he's addressing that in this class, how losing focus is really one of the main challenges for the human mind. And thus for human society, and that becomes a political problem.
So he, I think he's maybe best known to the public for being a thinker about ethics of artificial intelligence. I took a class with him and Jonathan Citrin this winter where they, among other things, talked about that. But we spent this hour talking about... among other things, the values of Silicon Valley, the values of this new power center in the world who is now building the world that we all inhabit, and how this engineering culture is shaping how we are able to communicate and what new services and how the economy is structured. And
well, values is a great... I mean, would you think after the conversation that they have values? Is that...
Yes.
But they're just alien from ours?
Yes.
Because in a way, yeah, that's an interesting point. We talked about the
maybe
origins of sort of the Asperger-ish world that we live in.
That was Ito's expression.
Boys with Asperger creating tools for themselves in Silicon Valley. But we also talked about the next step, a word which is fascinating to you. So how do you deal with death? How do you do away with death? That's, I think, the next project
for this
in Silicon Valley.
For this small contingency of people. And I had never heard the expression deathists. And that's apparently what these Silicon Valley... hotshots call the people who don't believe that it's possible to, within a generation or two, create the antidote to death for this small elite group, of course.
So it was a deep dive?
It was a deep dive in... And it wasn't very optimistic. He's a very cheerful person, but when we talked about the future of the institutions we have and the kind of how mismatched they are compared to the speed he sees now in terms of how the world is changing. He didn't sound very optimistic at all.
That was
about
part.
The future of democracy as we know it, I guess.
That was a great conversation, very engaging. And as usual, if you like it, please. Tweet about it.
Tweet about it and rate it, please, in iTunes.
Enjoy. Hello and welcome, Joy Ito. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
We're here at the
MIT Media Lab, the famed MIT Media Lab. And I think the way to start this conversation might be to reflect a little about this place, because I've taken classes here, Karin has taken classes here, and it's a very inspiring place. A friend of mine who works here said the other day, nothing really came out of the Media Lab invention-wise so far, but still it's a magical place for ideas or to bring together people. And I'm curious about that, because I think it ties into a broader theme of how change can happen in society, or how you rethink eventually how things are done in a democracy, or how to define democracy. So I'm curious about not the whole history of the Media Lab, which was founded in the 90s by Nicholas Negroponte, and you came here in 2011.
Yeah.
So but maybe sort of this time at the Media Lab. So what's the specific, what do you do here? What's the secret, and what's the mission?
Well, I will say we have invented stuff. One thing very important for the web is we invented the cascading style sheet, CSS, because the web was so ugly. But we worked a lot on the early internet standards. A lot of the things that came out of here are parts of other things. So e-ink was invented here, and a lot of the internet messaging was invented here. A lot of the parts when you open a personal computer or think about messaging on the internet. So it was originally part of the architectural school. There was a thing called the Architecture Machine Group, which was the first sort of multimedia workstations back then. And the idea of Nicholas was to get multimedia workstations on everyone's desktop. Nicholas famously said in the 90s that newspapers would be delivered over networks, and everybody laughed at him. And so a lot of the Media Lab has been about sort of building and predicting the future. And a lot of the stuff that we have is kind of, you know, the idea is invented here. So touchscreen, multi-touch, all of those were first shown at the Media Lab. So we have the members really kind of get inspired here, and then they go off and build them. So we don't necessarily get credit for everything, but we're usually a lot of times the people who are coming up with the ideas before others. And so the mission of the Media Lab is really to explore those spaces So our program is called Media Arts and Sciences. So it's arts, design, science, and technology, and looking for those spaces that it's difficult for traditional research labs to go because they're constrained by the constraints of their discipline, or they're constrained by the constraints of their funding. And so we're always trying to keep moving. So we started 31 years ago in computers and multimedia, and then we went to internet and networks, and then we went to data and AI. AI we've been doing since the beginning, and then more recently I think we've been shifting to the hard sciences like biology and microelectronics. And so right now I think a lot of our work is and it's always, we call it anti-disciplinary, so the space between the disciplines. So many of our labs, all of our labs, have multiple disciplines and different types of people. So again, I think we get between the disciplines by pulling these things together. But a lot of our work right now is biomedical. And then the last thing I'll say is that we instead of doing academia or academic publishing as a primary thing, a lot of the work that we do is about deploying into the real world. And so Nicholas famously said, demo or die, instead of publish or perish. And I added the idea of deploying things more and more.
So it is a workshop atmosphere or a lab, as you say, very practical on the one hand, but I think more so it's very much a way of thinking here. And I'm curious about that. In your book Whiplash, or you have general sort of principles of what you believe the Media Lab is about, or I guess what you think, and that's a question the future is about, or will, should be about. So it's there's an anti-authoritarian streak in that. There's an anarchistic streak in that, I would think. There's a very fundamentally democratic streak in that. And an interdisciplinary the words that you use are like emergence versus authority, or disobedience versus obedience, bottom up, pull versus push. Can you explain a little, as Karin says, the mission or the, sort of the philosophy, the way of thinking that you try to teach here?
So a couple of different parts, right? So So we are the only lab that is also an academic program. So we are able to redesign the way we think about learning. Instead of lectures and textbooks, we learn through doing. They call it constructionist theory, which is actually comes from Piaget. It goes to Seymour Papert and now to Mitch Resnick. But the idea is that you learn by doing projects rather than learning through textbooks or through pure theory. So the idea of building to learn and is kind of, in a way, practice and deploying is kind of like working class academics, right? Like really high level academics love the theory. We think that the practice actually informs your ability to think about things and to learn. And so in that sense, even from an academic perspective, it's somewhat democratic in that it's about actually doing things. And for us, I've been here, this is my sixth year, but I come from the internet, which was about permissionless innovation, about bottom up, about sort of this generative internet innovation and democracy. And it's interesting how even though the Media Lab was predates a lot of the internet pieces, it has very similar philosophy. And I think there are people at the Media Lab who aren't necessarily left wing or bottom up in terms of grassroots in terms of their politics, but they all lean towards this idea of questioning authority and disrupting the status quo. And in a way, whether you're a scientist trying to question a existing theory of science or whether you're a activist trying to fight for civil rights, the behavior of sort of questioning authority, thinking for yourself, and being somewhat creating somewhat of an emergent order, they have a lot of similarities. And I think that the idea of also just constantly challenging each other is part of the DNA of the lab.
I'm curious about that because I think that the will inform the conversation. This dichotomy between a certain optimism about technology or a pessimism that, mm-hmm. that you can have towards the realities of technology, and that ambivalence is I guess true in what you say, but so you talk about this disruption in a way, which is the philosophy of the Silicon Valley, and it's often mm-hmm. different. It's different, I would argue, from what you describe, because you're mm-hmm. I mean you say challenging authority, yes. That is disruption, but your words are different and your mm-hmm. concepts are different. Mm-hmm. So I would mm-hmm. argue that you're a part of this side of the gap. And there's another side of the gap, which is sort of the more Peter Thielian philosophy. Could you describe sort of your view of politics in that context or your role in that realm?
So I would say that I don't necessarily speak on behalf of the Media Lab on everything. I'm in charge of a certain environment management, but the Media Lab is extremely diverse in terms of people's views. So I would say that we have a very...
But this is specifically about you then.
But I would say, we have a healthy dose of techno-optimism here. I don't think there is as many singularity believers. But generally, I think we would have a healthy dose of techno-utopians, but we also have a pretty healthy dose of critical designers and questioners. And it creates an interesting dynamic, and I think we also attract a lot of people who are very optimistic and we want to invent the future and so on. But I think that the skepticism is also built into our system. So many of our, like for instance, Hiromi Ozaki comes from Royal College of Harvard, worked on critical design, and all of her work is kind of questioning technology. So that's built in as a sort of, hopefully, some balance. My personal view is that the unchecked techno-utopian, and I've been criticized of being techno-utopian too, so it sort of depends on where you are on the spectrum. I'm generally optimistic about technology, but I feel that we fundamentally... the people who have control of the technology, I think, are misguidedly optimistic, And to your point, I think that there is a Silicon Valley style. I'm from that community, so I know it very well. And I've definitely changed a lot since I moved to the East Coast and have been spending more time with social scientists and lawyers and others. But I think it's an important time because you can sit here and shake your finger at Silicon Valley, but you have to make them listen to you. And the only way that we can listen to them and they can listen to us is we have to create a common language. And so one of the things, you know, in sort of biology, if you look at you disable viruses or you see the predator and prey systems, is you kind of have to understand the algorithm of your opponent in order to take their energy. And you can't really, you know, intervene in Silicon Valley without understanding Silicon Valley, the gods they worship, the beliefs they have. And it's hard to understand something until you kind of are able to also sometimes put yourself in their shoes. And I think one of the interesting things about Silicon Valley is they've got this reinforcement system where they have a basic belief, I think, in Silicon Valley that, like, if you go to Marc Andreessen's office at the big venture capital fund, it says software will eat the world. You know, there's a big picture. And they believe that you can point software at anything, and especially with, you know, this new artificial intelligence getting smarter and smarter and smarter, and they, you know, say smarter than humans, you know, sometime soon, that that everything can be solved with this. And the markets and the companies they built have sort of reinforce this view, because the successful people are all billionaires, right? And if you measure your success by money, clearly Silicon Valley feels like their model has been successful. So they're you know, it's definitely continuing. Their star is continuing to rise. Yeah.
So I'm super curious about that, and I guess also coming from Europe and coming from geographically a space that's far away mm-hmm. from where we are now, the American East Coast, but even farther away from the West Coast and Silicon Valley that you're talking about. And you're talking about this, the people that are in control of the companies and the structures and the algorithms that are more and more structuring our lives are come from techno-optimism. And then you're talking about, you know, you mentioned the gods they worship. And can you talk a little bit more about that? What kind of values is it that you're actually talking about? Is it market fundamentalism, libertarianism? What is it that these people worship, and what is it that they're trying to build?
Excuse me. So I think one way to think about it is you have to imagine yourself as a young white boy who is slightly Asperger's, so you don't like the messiness of interacting with humans, you don't like looking girls in the eye, everything is a little bit confusing, but you have a computer. And the computer you program, and the computer does exactly like you say, and you get better and better at programming the computer, and the computer becomes more and more powerful, and you realize that you can create software and design it to do all kinds of things, and you get better and better at communicating with the computer, and you become, you know, a software genius. You know, not genius, but very productive in the computer. So, and then the real world continues to be scary and messy, right? And then you make a software system. It could be whatever. I won't name names because then you'll match them with the people. But imagine that you get a successful company and it starts to go. And a lot of these companies, actually the systems are kind of the online scalable version of the thing that they wish they had, you know. So if you're a lonely person, you're going to set up a social network for dating, or you might, you know, and then what happens is you start to realize that, you know, with computers, with algorithms, you can make very complex things very simple. You can take over markets. You can, and it starts to reinforce this idea that with enough, with the right algorithm and the right execution in a very engineering kind of way, you can build systems that make all of this messy stuff straightforward or simple. Like search has become easier, networking has become easier, car hailing has become easier. So much of the messy world is becoming organized, and the people who have designed these have become billionaires. But they're this method, whether it's the business success or the fact that they're able to make these complex systems quite simple through algorithms, is reinforcing the idea that maybe if someday, if they could just get the algorithm right and they train it with the right data, all this messy stuff like politics and society, everything will just go away because the computer will just be so smart that it will transcend the inability for humans to get out of their own way, and that our brains will, you know, get uploaded into computers and the computers will just get infinitely smart. And this transcendence idea is kind of consistent with this geometric growth in wealth, in power. And if you look at sort of the power of computing also, it kind of goes along this curve. And the god that they worship is that, and I say they, I mean, I would say, but a decent chunk of these people in Silicon Valley, I think, is that they may argue about when singularity will come, but they mostly believe that singularity is coming. And that many of them believe they'll live forever, and so that they will beat death. And so sort of it's also kind of interesting because this immortality has become kind of the god of atheists, right? Because I think if you're non-atheist, you don't really care about death. The singularity people call them deathists, you know, people who believe in death, because you have an afterlife, right? But if you don't have an afterlife, you have to beat death. And so the singularity people believe that in immortality, either through transcendence into computers or through the idea that we will sort of beat biology, either directly or through computers. But this idea also, many of these people believe this is going to happen in the next 10 years or maybe in maybe 2040, but that a lot of these problems that we have will be manageable as long as we get the algorithm right. So they're not really that interested in politics or all this other law. They think that...
So it's a personal project more than a project for humanity, or how...
But I think, you know, and some of these people are my friends, but, you know, they believe that they have to hedge their risks, so make sure we can escape to Mars, make sure we can do this, make sure we can do that, but that if they can just beat this horizon line, this sort of event horizon of, okay, if you can just live another 10 years, you'll be immortal. If you can just live another 20 years, computers will be so good that wars won't happen anymore. You know, so it's just this race against running away from the... I mean, it reminds me of the book, you know, by Francis Fukuyama about end of history.
Yeah.
So there's this idea that if they can just get past this dark age, that we will be in this beautiful utopia. And the problem with this kind of idea, even if it may be true, right? There's a possibility something like this could be true. But if you kind of constantly bet on it, no one's taking care of this messy stuff. And a lot of these people have money, power, influence. And I think the risk for me that I see is that if you get the timing wrong, you know, one of my friends who's very into this is German, you know, and he says, yeah, eventually it will all figure itself out. But I said, if you get the timing wrong, you could have a Holocaust level incident before it corrects, you know, and you have to kind of be doing all of this messy politics stuff right now. But I think the current political environment has shaken them up a little bit. I think that our inability to address climate and looking at some of the models for climate are making many of Silicon Valley folks concerned. So, but the way that I think Silicon Valley thinks about solving problems is also different, because they think about entrepreneurship and disruption and software as the primary tools rather than you know, collective action or sort of bottom-up work, even though many of the companies in Silicon Valley are exist on the basis of widely popular consumer services.
I have a question. I have a background in economics, and there's this ongoing debate in economics now about why kind of the gains, the productivity gains with the new inventions in the tech industry is not spreading through to the real economy in a larger degree. And I was just wondering, when you're talking now, is that connected to the philosophy, to this philosophy? Is it connected to the fact that there's no real project of kind of spreading these new technologies or this new knowledge? And that kind of creates an insularity, or just this smaller spaces where things are moving fast and not really affecting a larger part of the world. Or what's your take on that?
I think that productivity gains one is a fairly complex question.
No, you know? It is. Yeah, sure.
Because I think, for instance, when we talk about productivity, we don't include child rearing, which I think is a hugely important function. So it's not clear that productivity gains are actually what we're looking for.
Yeah,
I think we want some societal value, and it's hard to just use GDP. On the other hand, I do think that that the idea of consumer internet is to create consumers, not so much producers, right? And I think that early eBay, when you talk to Pierre, I thought that was kind of a cool thing because it unlocked a lot of jobs for people that, that didn't exist before. But more and more, I think the services that we see being created, they're solutions to problems, but they're not tools to generate.
Yeah.
And so we talked about this in our class, but the generative internet. So in the old days, you had, a PC that you could do anything with, and you had VisiCalc, which was a way, the spreadsheet allowed accountants to pour their creativity into computers. Now you have an iPhone where you're not allowed to hack anything. And so what I think we're seeing, and also like coding, I think coding, learning to code, a lot of it is to get a job in a big IT company. It's not to write your own code for your own little business, right? So I think that the business model with the cloud and with a lot of these things is trying to sell solutions and services to people rather than giving them tools to build their own thing. Now they will argue that, oh no, we have tools. This is a tool. That's a tool. But I think the mindset is much more of a solution based system. But I don't know how we should think about productivity gains, because I think one of the other questions is sort of the goals of society. Is growth and productivity how we should be measuring the value of society, or is there something else like flourishing, or arts or other things that aren't calculated into productivity?
So George and I have been this semester auditing a class with a Brazilian philosopher and thinker, politician, Roberto Mangabeira Unger, and he talks a lot about the inability of the maturity of the both people and the economy to catch up with the vanguard. Mm-hmm. And he uses Silicon Valley as a metaphor and as an example of a place where a lot of creativity happens and new ways of working, of thinking happens, and kind of the tragedy of those ways of thinking and working together is not spreading to the rest of the economy. And it's not only about productivity gains, it's also about quality of life and being able to exist in a creative space. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about why it's so hard then for those practices to kind of spread to the economy as a whole.
Well, Silicon Valley has a philosophy and a method that has become extremely competitive and well-defined. So if you go to Silicon Valley, it's not easy. There's tons of competition. And, I think that the problem is that it's similar when you come out to sort of the Ivy League schools in the East Coast. It's because you have so many academics here, it forces everybody to be competitive. And so in any situation, or like Shenzhen, you create this this density that makes the competition so high, so that and smaller versions of it just can't compete with these big systems. And again, it I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that the internet has allowed, you can be in Silicon Valley and create Uber that hits the whole world, right? And so you can basically build everything in Silicon Valley but sell it everywhere in the world. So I was talking to one hedge fund guy who thinks that 15% of the world's economy will eventually go through Silicon Valley. And because if you're talented, that's the place you go, right? Similarly, all of the manufacturing keeps going through Shenzhen because that's where all of the manufacturing skills are. So I think the globalization, ironically, has created these massive global centers for particular types of things. It just turns out that software, which is Silicon Valley's main thing, is at least in this period, is an extremely efficient way of disintermediating and creating economic value. I think the next phase could be biotech, or it could be artificial intelligence, or it could be many things. And it doesn't always have to be Silicon Valley, but in the short run, I think they're... But I don't think Silicon Valley is going to have a monopoly on innovation because sort of by definition, because of the way they're working, they do have some biotech and they do have other things. But this method that they've perfected doesn't work on every problem. And I think even if they take 15% of the world's GDP, there's still 85% left.
So when you think about democracy or changing institutions or even just the public having like a minimum of insight and into what's happening in these places where this new technology is created, which affects all of us, what are the new institutions that are that we need? Because it seems to me that there's this massive power shift now, and all these resources concentrated in fewer and fewer places, and you know, this explosion of inequality. What and how do you think about that?
Yeah, I there's a great article by Marshall Gantz on sort of activating the progressive grassroots.
Social organizer, yeah. And kind of Harvard legend.
Yeah, and you know, very big part of Chavez, very big part of President Obama's Camp Obama. Also, I think he was involved in Bernie's campaign. But he's great, and he's basically identified that, in his view, that it's not the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. It was the Tea Party. It was the local activism over decades, and the churches and everyone that sort of ignited this new sort of generation of conservatives in the U.S. And that the progressives have completely lost touch with these groups. And now you see that, you know, with the town hall meetings and things like that, the progressives are starting to organize in local communities, and that local community organizing is going to be a key part of rebalancing what's going on. And I think that's true. I mean, I think that, you know, there obviously there's some institution building that needs to go on at multiple levels, both locally and sort of, you know, the future of journalism. You know, there's a lot of things we need to work on. But I think that the sort of democratic process and the engagement, I would be very curious about learning more about how it's working in Europe. But I think that we've been doing too much centralized institution building. And you know, in a way, Silicon Valley.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
There's a great book by Annalise Saxenian called Regional Advantage, about how Boston lost the computer industry to Silicon Valley because we had these large institutions that focused on funding and permission and authority. And once the cost of doing things went down so much that just students could do stuff, the model of venture capitalists chasing these entrepreneurs made sense. You know, but I think similarly, politics and others, we'd been building these large institutions with these plans and all this. And then this kind of anti-institutional grassroots movement has captured the moment, and I think we need to think about that.
Yeah, but even so, I guess that's a U.S. problem also, the political extreme political polarization here. And even though we have the same kind of right-wing populist movements in Europe, but I'm also thinking about just the fact that we now have these huge companies, more powerful than, you know, big nation states, building our information infrastructure, mm-hmm. controlling our flow of news, using our data. Mm-hmm. And how should we think about that as citizens and as Democrats, with small d Democrats, how to counter the power of these companies and to make them accountable somehow?
So I think of it with biological metaphors. I think that these monopolies, whether they're, you know, gun lobby or whether they're some of these big companies, are like cancers, right? So what happens is, in a normal system, you have these regulatory mechanisms or an immune system that sort of tries to counteract the uncontrolled growth. And we built a democratic system with checks and balances and lawmaking and da-da-da-da, that when things move slowly before the internet, the lawyers and the judges could kind of keep track of things and break up the monopolies and challenge those in power. And the journalists could challenge these powerful institutions. But now with the speed and the scale and the ability for people to direct power in a very sophisticated way, it's almost impossible now to slow the gains of these powerful organizations, because they have, like you said, they have usurped the ability for, this is a Lawrence Lessig's point, but, you know, the role of money in politics has gotten to the point that it's uncheckable. My view is the role of machine learning and AI will get to the point where they will become somewhat uncheckable. And so what we're dealing with is we're dealing with a somewhat outdated biological system with an immune system that isn't prepared. And we're infected with a whole new class of virus.
This sounds really, really, really dangerous.
Yeah, I think it's very dangerous. And I think the problem is the answer isn't a political answer. It's not like you can just cut out one of the cancers. We now have a system where this whole new category of cancer is unmanageable with the immune system that we have. And so I think what needs to happen is it's some fundamental things. Like, we need to rethink how law works. We need to rethink how auditing and accounting works. We need to rethink how the judicial system works. And it's an architectural change, not just a content change. Because you get rid of one of these, the next one will come. I mean, so I'm somewhat pessimistic in the short term, because I think all of the traditional devices that we have, the traditional media, the traditional lawmaking process, they're not functioning anymore.
Okay. George wants to ask questions too, but I have to follow up on this. So you're mentioning the media, and you are on the board of the New York Times.
Yeah.
So what do you think, what do you tell the New York Times and other media companies, how should they act in this environment when Facebook and Google are basically stealing their content, monetizing their content, and destroying their business model? And democracy kind of on the way. what's your advice? How do you think about that?
To who? To New York Times?
No, I don't know. You can speak in general terms.
I think in general terms, I mean, I think that what is happening is, first of all, I believe that innovation and adaptation comes eventually when you need it. So spam got really bad and we were about to shut down the internet, and then we kind of figured it out. And the reason I don't believe in singularity is almost anything, whether it's an epidemic or a stock bubble, eventually corrects itself. And so I think it's going to get worse before it gets better, but that we will, first of all, the young people will start to develop literacies that we don't have right now. So some of it is generational. I think that, the Facebooks of the world, just even during the last year have gone from saying, we are not editors to, okay, we've got to do something. And so there's an awareness in the platforms. I think, to put my New York Times hat on, we have a new generation of leadership at the New York Times, which are more tech savvy. We're thinking about our role. We're constantly thinking about how we interact with Facebook. Where are we? What are we doing here? And we'll see if we survive. But I think that, I think it's going through a very tough period. But I think tough periods are when people become creative. And I think the other part is that, I want to be careful about how I say this, but, even with under Trump right now, so government institutions are not very efficient. and they're not very good at evolving. And whether you talk about the EPA or any of these other things, I think what's happening right now is terrible. You know, on the other hand, the traditional way of trying to, like, so even under Al Gore, the EPA had a really difficult time reforming itself. So kind of sometimes you need a shock to the system for the system to start to change. And I think right now what's happening is there's a shock. I think it's going to be very painful. But I think and I hope that what emerges out of this new system is going to be more robust, more thoughtful. I think maybe reinventing some of these institutions. When I talk to some of the people who are now working together, who would never have worked together if the world was going better. And those are the sparks, I think, that will generate new ideas. So I think it's going to be painful. I'm short-term pessimistic, but long-term, I feel like we have the opportunity to try things no one would have tried before, because there's almost nothing to lose.
I'm curious. I would like to go back to this one description, to the description of Silicon Valley, which I found really telling. So of the emptiness at the core, the authoritarian streak in the valley, or the religious aspect, and the questions of why would they be different? I mean, why would you try to place values in this system? Meaning, why? So I think the problem might be that you look to the valley for answers that aren't there, because it's not about politics. So if it's, mm-hmm. it's not, they don't think about society, as you say clearly. They just imply that they have the means to change, and they do. So I think my question would be, so Manchester capitalism or factories just were political and so societal revolutions, but they had a system of politics that came from that structure, which is representative democracy, which we still have. Mm-hmm. So, but they didn't change they didn't establish the way the politics was done. They just changed the way society worked. So eventually somebody came along and figured it out. And from what you wrote early in 2003 about emergence and democracy, so you were very constructively thinking about technology in this democratic way and challenging the way representative democracy is done. So I'm curious about that. So sort of how do you envision that new form of democracy that is probably not representative, but much more mm-hmm. direct and mm-hmm. much less based on maybe election or electoral circles? And then secondly, I would be curious, because you're so admirably precise sometimes about employing technology in a specific context, as you say, changing the legal structure. You talked about or wrote about employing AI in the judicial system, replacing judges, which sounds to a lot of people, I guess, shocking. But I guess that's the problem. It's not shocking. It's mm-hmm. it makes sense. So I guess the two questions would be related in a way to how would Joy Ito's just new world, mm-hmm. brave new world, mm-hmm. Look like?
Yeah. So I think AI is a topic we can talk about for a minute, but. And it's slightly related, but not exactly with the way that Silicon Valley, I think, is operating. I think Silicon Valley, first of all, I think part of this is related to this American dream that, you know, wealth represents success and success represents intelligence. And I think that, you know, right now, Silicon Valley is very wealthy and very powerful. So obviously people ask Silicon Valley for the answers. I don't think that most of the people in Silicon Valley are unethical or evil. I think they have just grown up in a environment that their the way that they think about how to come up with a solution is very sort of homogeneous and has a particular point of view. And I think where you might want more diversity, they have one way to approach things, and so far it's been successful for a whole category of things. So I don't attribute too much malice to them, and I think that a lot of them are overly optimistic about the solving things in software that would require more fundamental engagement or changing, especially when you're, you know, because I guess my point is that, you know, yes, you can scale Facebook or whatever to reach everyone, but you're actually not engaging them in something like a democratic process. You're engaging them as a consumer of a service, which is, I think, slightly different. On AI, just to be a little be specific, I think that, you know, so Julia Angwin's paper, which was about, she in ProPublica, and I think she was a Pulitzer finalist this year, but she showed that, at least in one county where she was able to get the data, that the judges were using, this risk score from the machine as a way to determine sentencing in addition to bail. And that for a set of category of people, mostly white males, that they were getting almost random, so not that useful. And then for African Americans, they were biased against. And when you look at the study, you know, they don't ask your race, but just by collecting the data and doing the analysis, the system was biased against them. And when I was talking to a prosecutor the other day, he said, you know, the problem is that if you let somebody off on bail and then they go and kill somebody, it's your problem. But if you say, no, but the risk rating said this, it's not your problem. So there's this interesting moral hazard right now that's already happening, which is if, you know, you have a machine making a decision for you, even if you're the one writing the sentencing or pushing the button, you already have given away your responsibility. And we see this in medicine. For instance, if you're a doctor and you imagine that there's a case that I heard where diagnostic, that when the doctor overrules the machine, the machine is right 70% of the time. Doctor's wrong 70% of the time. So if that's true as a doctor, it's going to be very difficult for you to overrule the computer. And similarly, if you're a pilot or even let's take these drone attacks. So they're controlled by humans, but a lot of the data that feeds into who's the target comes from machines that are looking at people's phone records and doing pattern recognition. So you may be allowing the human to push the button for the kill decision, but the kill decision may have been already informed mostly by machines. So I think that AI is already engaged. I think that even though humans may be pushing the button and it feels like agency, in fact, it's not if you don't have the ability to overrule. If computer says, pick A, B, C, or D, but I think it's C, the human's going to push C. So when we talk about autonomous systems, judges, fighter pilots, doctors, or autonomous vehicles, I think that if your job is just to push the button, it's already the machine in charge. Now, everyone's afraid of these robots with full autonomy, but I'm already afraid of machines controlling this. And I think the answer, and this is Media Lab, we love to work on interfaces. So what we want is we want an answer from the machine which involves the human being in the modeling of the answer. Because the problem is if machine produces answer, human approves the answer, there's no input from the human. So what you want is a system where we call it human in the loop or society in the loop, so that the machine is modeling the human and the human's opinion is coming into the machine, and then you've jointly cooperated on the answer. So there has to be an evolution of a new system where, and it's kind of like with chess. So you had humans losing to chess machines, and now we find that a combination of humans and machines can beat computers in chess. And so this sort of collaborative relationship between humans and machines, both at the individual level but also at the collective intelligence system level, is really important. And I think what we're doing right now, and this gets back to the Silicon Valley part, is you have a lot of computer scientists who come to try to solve your problem. So your doctor will give you a diagnostic machine. Here you go. And then you have a doctor with some computer scientists who have programmed the machine, in their view, to solve your problem. It's giving you an answer. You may be right 30% of the time, but you're going to keep clicking yes because you're afraid to risk the 70% of being wrong. What we need is we need a tool for the doctor to understand the machine, to then guide the machine together and put the doctor's opinions so that the machine and the doctor together come in with the answer.
So just to give an example, I remember from class you talked about mm-hmm. the self-driving cars, yep, and the biker on the right with a helmet, and the biker on the left without the helmet. Could you just talk about that example, because I think it's interesting.
Yeah. So a lot of people think that all you need for self-driving cars is to follow the law, but it turns out that human beings make a lot of trade-off decisions, and some people, we call this a trolley problem from philosophy. Some people argue that the trolley problem is kind of edge case and is too philosophical, but I think it's important. So the example that I think that Karen, you just mentioned, was the one that I use in class, where if you're driving and you have a guy on the left without a helmet and the guy on the right with a helmet, and there's a helmet law, and then you have to swerve because somebody jumps in front of your car. Do you swerve and hit the guy with the helmet, or do you swerve and hit the guy without the helmet? And I'll say in the U.S., most people swerve to the guy with the helmet because he's more likely to survive. So this is a utility over law, in my view. I did this to a Japanese automobile company research team, and half the class said, we'll hit the guy without the helmet. He should die. He's breaking the law, you know. And to me, that's the values of that community. And so if you're a car driving through a neighborhood, and let's say you have a baby who is sick, and there's a red light, the car should say, okay, I'm now in a neighborhood. What's the neighborhood's opinion on law versus baby's life? And negotiate with the traffic light. Okay, I'm going to run this light. And because so I guess the point, and I think what is that the law is not just black and white. There's a human element, and if it's a very nice day with no traffic, you should be able to go faster than if it's a wet day. And the algorithm needs to pull into the behavior the human values. But the question is, how are those human values brought in? Because the human isn't going to be making the split second decisions, but the human should somehow be able to inform the machine about the values of society. And this gets back to basic lawmaking, right? In the U.S., especially with common law is supposed to reflect the sort of the practices of the day. And so somehow the judge is supposed to, and the jury is supposed to reflect, you know, this application of the Constitution in the values of the day. But the values of the day evolve, and the values of the day are influenced by the technologies of the day. So you have AI coming in to influence our behavior, and then our behavior should influence the law, and the law should influence the technology. And this gets back to this the Lessig thing, we call it the Lessigian quadrants, where you have law, norms, society, and technology, and how they relate with each other. And I think what we will see is this kind of coevolution. And I do think, though, that you know, in the future, short term, we'll have machines doing a lot of work and things like checking the speed, although I just gave a talk today and somebody said, but you know, you don't want everyone to be too strict on speed because it depends on the environment. And then you have the Supreme Court in the United States, where you probably don't want robots, although one of the new candidates behaves like a robot. But you want that to be very human and very values driven. And then there's somewhere in between, right? And so certain cases you want people to be able to make human judgments. But that, I think, that evolution is going to be critical. I think, though, what will be interesting is I think Europe and Japan and the U.S. are going to develop very different approaches and values. And I think we'll start to see that reflected in law and in the way we think about AI.
Yeah, I think it's very telling, as you described, that the fight for democracy more or less is now not against machines, but it's in machines. Mm-hmm. So that's where happens, that's where it takes place. And you say humans in the loop or society in the loop, which is I guess a place like MIT Media Lab is a place where humanities and technology sort of could come together and form mm-hmm. this kind of knowledge. I'm still curious, you're avoiding in a way the description of the system surrounding that. I guess mm-hmm. with the Lessig quadrant, it makes sense that change happens through all four factors. Mm-hmm. Values being, I guess, the most, important, but also mm-hmm. slowest, maybe, I guess. But if you take your description of how you think the world mm-hmm. works in the 21st century or should work, so if this the bottom up approach and mm-hmm. the the compass, not the map, the bottom up, and the emergence of the swarm intelligence. Mm-hmm. That's all not the way the politics in the classical parliamentary Brexit Trumpian way, in this brutalist 20th century way, works today. Do you have a path for that, or do you if you say short term pessimistic, long term optimistic, how really concretely how long do you think the system works?
Well, I think I don't know how much is generational or not, but if you look at, and this is Joshua Ramo's book, The Age of the Unthinkable, and also his recent one, Seven Sense, talks about this, but the world is now, you know, whether we're talking about a little while ago, Hezbollah, and now ISIS, it's a completely networked system, and our international relations and the way that we think about defense and politics is completely hierarchical and crystalline, right? And the institutions are completely behind. And so we can't win against these big network systems it's kind of like in American history, it's the redcoats versus the guerrilla. I guess in Europe, it would be Napoleon versus the traditional method. I think that we're going through a transformation and we've had these in histories when you invent artillery, when, you know, the longbow, you know, these all changed fundamentally the way that politics and war works. So I think we're going through one fairly massive transformation of hierarchical systems versus distributed network systems. So that's what I think we're seeing. And I think that if you look at the people who are in charge of the institutions, they don't understand. The other thing is even just debugging the system, just going back to Julia Engwin and her identifying that this just judiciary is now depending on a system that's random or maybe negative. But she wrote this over a year ago. Nothing's happened. You know, we haven't fixed this. And we're talking about judges who are supposed to be paying attention to this kind of thing, but they still continue to use these risk ratings and things like that. So my fear is that there's no one whose job it is to fix these kinds of problems, because they're not in the sort of target of the kinds of problems. This is why the immune system is a good example. This is a kind of pathogen that we don't have a targeted defense for. So they easily sneak into the system. And again, Pulitzer Prize nominated article about it, but no one's changing. You know, you talk to Julia and, she's still very passionate about this. And this is why I want us as technologists to get involved too, because I think that it's almost has a technical element. So for instance, you know, I think we need to work on a system that audits any data set or machine learning system. But right now it's all proprietary. I don't think that they know how to think about it, you know. So if you're a lawyer, you don't know how to think about how should I go after this problem, because it's in a category that didn't exist before. And I think there's a lot of those things where there's no, talking about building institutions, there's no one whose job it is to go after this problem or this problem or this problem. And so, and the new problem types or the new attack vectors or the new the cancer types are evolving faster than we can keep up.
Is that why you're interested in, for example, civil disobedience, as you had a call for a price for $250,000? Why you're interested in nonviolent?
This could be interesting to our listeners, actually. There's a prize. You can win $250,000 at MIT if you are engaged in civil disobedience in a constructive way, in a way that changes society for the better.
Yeah, it's not just civil disobedience. Any kind of disobedience, and it's for societal good in a nonviolent way, in a responsible way. And there's a lot of criteria on our page that you should read. Some of the kids on the internet say it sounds like an obedience award because we have too many criteria. But then also the conservative people here tell me that it's dangerously political. But I think the idea is that, you know, you don't win a Nobel Prize by doing exactly as you're told. You don't change the laws by just obeying them. One of my favorite quotes is the Martin Luther King quote about, you know, you have the moral imperative to follow just laws, but also more imperative to resist unjust laws. And when you talk to, you know, judges, they say you should question the law, you should question authority and think for yourself. And I think it's an extremely important part of democracy, which is to question authority. And if you don't agree, you should say it. You know, and I mean, even on the test to get the U.S. citizenship, it says very clearly, you know, that your role is to, you know, pick a political position and to speak up and to, you know, be, you know, they don't say disobedient, but at least, you know, dissent and free speech are enshrined in the United States and most democratic places. So I think that, you know, right now we have built a lot of institutions that have, even the institutions like academia and others in science, you know, a lot of the institutions have built these systems that are trying to defend against things that shake them up. But I think, you know, whether it's the Media Lab or you know, the public, I think it's and we, by the way, we announced this prize last year in July before the election. So disobedience has become quite popular. But we designed this before.
A lot of good candidates.
Yes.
For the prize, I can imagine
a lot of unusual candidates. Yeah.
Right.
But
last question.
Mm-hmm. So it's a metaphysical question. No, it's about the techniques of change. You said nonviolent action. That's what we talked about in the awareness class, but also the strategies of awareness or mm-hmm. meditation mm-hmm. or Eastern Western philosophy, non-dualistic mm-hmm. or dual thinking. Are all these, I mean, those are all old strategies, and mm-hmm. sometimes they come from the 60s and 70s, mm-hmm. like Marshall Gantz's approach to societal change. Are all these strategies that are connected in a way for you with this a network approach to societal change or technology? So are these fields that inspire each other? So if this mm-hmm. non-dualistic thinking, which is basically, I guess, mm-hmm. Cybernetic mm-hmm. in origin represents the way that networks are working within machines and
yeah, I think we built a lot of institutions, a lot of rules, a lot of philosophies around a particular short period of history after the Industrial Revolution, when you had scalable distribution and you had specialization and mass production. And we think we've been this way forever, whether it's our capitalist system or our political system. I think, in fact, we're finishing a phase. And I think we need to go back to first principles. And whether it's our relationship to nature, whether it's our awareness of ourself. And I think that, you know, this was a weird period in history. And you know, a lot of the stuff that we used to do still make sense. And you know, I think, like, even if you just go back a little bit further, but you know, the idea that growth is good, you know, that's relatively new. It's kind of actually was a European thing, right? So when the Europeans went to Australia and they met the Aborigines, whose goal was to thrive in nature but not to gain or progress, the Europeans said, oh, they're not humans, because all humans want to grow. And so they shot them as animals. And until as recently as the 60s, I think they were listed in the textbooks in Australia as like fauna, you know. And how could they be human if they don't want to kill each other and steal the free energy, you know? But I think a lot of things that we think of as like modern human core values are actually new. They're post-Industrial Revolution. Maybe they're even, some of these are post-monotheism, you know. And so by rolling back to before some of these modern historical events, we may think of and find new ways to ask the questions. So there's a great essay by Donella Meadows on how to intervene in complex systems, and she talks about, you know, the lowest being changing the data, then there's the rules, and then you get to the goals, but the most important is the paradigm. And I think right now we're living in a paradigm that was generated for post-monotheism, post-industrial revolution. And you know, there's an interesting project right now among environmentalists, which is that about 25% of the world's land is controlled by indigenous people. And about 80% of the carbon sink and about 80% of the biodiversity is on this 25% of the land. And when you look at these indigenous people, they're typically not sort of, they're just, they flourish in nature. So it's not about sustainability, spending less, lowering your carbon footprint. These people have a philosophy that works very well with nature, and it predates a lot of these other things. And so when traditional conservation has been kind of top down, and they kind of thought these primitives didn't have any of the solution, we need to kind of out-science the system. But there's a new thinking that says maybe there's something that we can learn from the indigenous people who seem to be thriving in nature. So some of this kind of hippie-like things that I talk about in my class is really trying to question some of the belief systems that we have and say maybe these belief systems don't make sense anymore because we don't have to make human beings behave like robots in factories if we have robots. And maybe when you grow past, maybe more than enough is too much, you know, and maybe we have more than enough. And so those are some of the questions that tie back to some of the, you know, without getting religious, I guess I mentioned monotheism. I tease monotheists a lot because I think, you know, they have a particular, you know, again, it's a kind of a new thing, you know. And I think it's interesting to look at societies that weren't monotheists, and instead of just looking at them as primitive, were there things that worked better before we had that?
On that note, wish we could continue this, but we only have an hour. Thank you, and I'm sure, I know, I've been reading your blog, so I know you're super busy, and I have a lot of emails to answer. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.